commodities of all other nations than our own.
By the way, if I remember well, Zimmer makes this point that there is a certain, perhaps a certain tension between this remark and...
So the sovereign people needs leaders, needs a government, and not everyone is fit for that. And while the sovereign people elect them, they cannot be a substitute for them. That's simple. You know, Mr. Voyen, did you have a point?
I'll ask one at least.
Yeah. The most pertinent, please.
Well, when you were talking about the difference between Rousseau's and Aristotle's meaning of freedom.
Yeah.
And you talk about Aristotle went beyond this and that freedom was required for the good life. Does one judge the good life? Does one have that judgment? For Aristotle, does one make judgment of what is the good life?
What do you mean by that?
Well,
I mean, do men know what the good life is? Of course, otherwise they couldn't speak of it. Whether everyone knows it is another question. But Aristotle, I think, would say this, that every not completely corrupted individual knows what the good life is. And even if he is aware that for one reason or the other he is not capable of leading it, he will have a kind of natural deference to it. Yeah? Say, for example, the farmers in the country, relatively uncorrupted people, they would naturally bow to the squires, to their betters. The people in the big cities, like Athens, especially those at the waterfront, yes, Jimmy Hoffa's boys, they would of course not bow to them, but they are obviously particularly corrupt people. It has a longer story, but in effect it comes down to this.
My only difficulty with it is then what kind of freedom is that?
A freedom in the service of comfortable self-preservation is one thing. A freedom in the service of a morally good life is another thing. That they are not, I don't say that they are incompatible, but they are different considerations. Now for Aristotle, the whole emphasis is on the latter freedom. And whereas for Hobbes and Locke, the whole emphasis is on the other one. Rousseau is somewhere in a way difficult to describe in between. Now, I will now permit me, yeah, Mr. Morrison?
I just asked if it's on the one before that, the one already. Did you say that this distinction between sovereign and government, Rousseau had made it more sharp than the previous
people? Yeah, well, I know only of one man. You must not forget, in classical philosophy it cannot exist, because the sovereign for Plato and Aristotle is the government, or vice versa. Now, not narrowly conceived, I mean, not the present administration, but the sovereign is the ruling body, not necessarily the present magistrate. This is uninteresting. The ruling body. The ruling body may be a few or maybe many. That doesn't make any. There is a ruling body in every, at least in every republican society, and this is the sovereign or the government, and the. There is, whereas in Rousseau you have the clear distinction, and prepared by certain things in Locke, for example, in Locke's distinction between the people and what he calls the supreme power. But it's by no means as clear in Locke as it is in Rousseau.
Now,
that's it. Exactly. Marsilius of Padua is the only earlier thing of whom I know who has something like this distinction. How does he call it? I forgot the name.
Principatus
is government, and how does he call the populus? The populus is, of course, he doesn't speak of sovereign, naturally. Although the term sovereign stems from medieval Latin, sovereignus, superannus, But he doesn't concern it, but what he in effect, I mean, one cannot read Marsilius without being reminded of the Rousseauian distinction. But I believe in Marsilius it is not ultimately maintained, the distinction. That it would be a long story, but in, yeah, that is perfectly defensive what you say. That's the last question now, otherwise we don't make any headway.
Do you want to go on?
No, no, all right. You have been waiting for it so long, please.
Does this gentleman here mean to imply that Emil is supposed to be the ruler of a new kind of society? Because I think there are many...
Yes, you can say that. I mean, he would be very best fitted.
Again, we knocked, and he answered.
He doesn't say you human beings, which as we know in Greek has a derogatory meaning, not andres and not andres, no. You would say this to men you despise, to slaves and other people. Yes, go on.
But, my friend, I said, you need not be alarmed, for we are not sophists, and we did not come to see Callias, but we do want to see Protagoras, and I must request you to announce us. At last, after a good deal of difficulty, the man was persuaded to open the door.
Yes, well, that is, you see, the subject of the non-reported conversation between Socrates and Hippocrates was such, perhaps, that the eunuch who heard it regarded Socrates and Hippocrates as sophists. But of course that doesn't mean very much, because this man was surely very incompetent to judge. Anything which went beyond his narrow horizon was probably sophistry. Now the eunuch, the lowest of the low, considers himself superior to the sophists, obviously. The sophists are even less masculine than eunuchs. For reasons which we have discussed on a former occasion, because sophists are men who talk and talk and talk and sit at home like women. In the eunuch's perspective, even the manly Hippocrates, to say nothing of Socrates, can appear to be a sophist. The eunuch is angry, as you see, as eunuchs are supposed to be particularly tame, see, like castrated horses and bulls. See Xenophon's Education of Cyrus, Book 7, Chapter 5, Paragraph 59 to 65. But, of course, this poor man suffers from unusual provocation. The big crowds of sophists and their followers cause him a lot of trouble. He has constantly to open the door and close. Now, Socrates and Hippocrates, as we have seen, do not use a stick for knocking at the door, as Hippocrates had done when knocking at Socrates' house. So the door is shut twice before their noses. The doorman is a kind of Cerberus, the hellhound. This enemy of the sophists makes access to the sophists very difficult, whereas access to Socrates, even before daybreak, is very easy, as we have seen. The sophists are very much indoor men. Socrates was always, as Xenophon puts it, in the open, in the marketplace. So one wonders whether he was also in the marketplace during nighttime or before daybreak, which of course cannot be the meaning. Of course, Socrates also does not demand money for his teaching. That's also easier to have access to a man who doesn't demand money for being seen than to a man who demands money for being seen, as I do not have to point out. In the clouds, the oldest presentation of Socrates, Socrates is difficult of access. But there a pupil and adherent of Socrates watches the entrance. In the Protagoras, a eunuch and enemy of the sophists watches the entrance. So it's much more difficult to get at Protagoras than to the sophist Socrates, as he is presented in Aristophanes' Cloud.
the sugariness of the clouds, we can also say, is difficult of access because he wishes to be difficult of access, in contradistinction to Protagoras, who is difficult of access not because he wishes to be difficult of access, but because he has such an unsympathetic dawn. In the Protagoras, the emasculated doorman tries to prevent Socrates and Hippocrates from seeing Protagoras. In the Gorgias, the very virile Callicles eagerly welcomes Socrates and Chaerephon to see Gorgias. The Gorgias, to repeat, is a voluntary dialogue, easy access to the hero. The Protagoras is a compulsory dialogue, and the hero is difficult of access. Now, this difficulty of access to the sophist is imitated by the plan of the Protagoras. We don't enter immediately, but we go first through the conversation with the comrade, then through the conversation with Hippocrates, and then only do we come to Protagoras himself. So now let us read now the seeker. So eventually the doorman has no choice but to open, and he opens. Do you want to say something?
This is a tribute to Socrates' use of rhetoric, two wisdoms, that he's able to sway the doorman, the unthinking doorman, to open the door.
Yeah. This must have had some authority in his voice if needed. I suppose it is a rhetoric meant here. It is of course clear that this description could never have been given in a performed dialogue. Yeah, only by narrating could he bring out this scene, this amusing scene, and also the immediate sequel, which is in a way still more amusing. Mr. Reinhardt.
When we entered, we found Protagoras taking a walk in the cloister, and attending him in proper order on one side were walking Callias, the son of Hipponicus, and Paralus, the son of Pericles, who, by the mother's side, is his half-brother, and Charmides, the son of Glaucon. On the other side of him were Xantippus, the other son of Pericles, Philippides, the son of Philomelus, also Antimoerus of Mende, who of all the disciples of Protagoras is the most famous and intends to make sophistry his profession. A train of listeners followed him. The greater part of them appear to be foreigners, whom Protagoras always brings with him out of the various cities visited by him in his journeys. He, like Orpheus, charming them with his voice, and they following its spell. I should mention
also, following his voice, charmed. Yeah. I mean, he repeats the same expression. Yes, that is what I said before about the intoxication. Yeah. Intoxication is a kind of charm. Yes?
I should mention also that there were some Athenians in the chorus. Nothing delighted me more than the spectacle of this chorus and the punctilious care they took never to get into Protagoras' way. But whenever he and those who were with him turned back, then the band of listeners parted regularly on either side, wheeled around, and took their places behind him in perfect order.
Yes. Not beautiful. The most visible of all is our hero, Protagoras. And he walks around. The word is the same in Greek, later peripatetics. And he is quite audible in what he says. He is accompanied by six men mentioned by name. They belong mostly to the cream of Athenians, of patrician. You see Pericles and Callias is an old family, and of course Charmides, the uncle of Plato, and so on. Yes. And Protagoras is compared to Orpheus. You know, Orpheus, who could charm all, not only men, but beasts as well. And Orpheus-like, accompanied by a chorus. Orpheus came from Thrace, and Protagoras also came from Thrace, it's a little bit. His chorus, however, different from a theatrical chorus, listens only. Only man with a voice in that chorus is the chorus leader. Now, the chorus is of course an apt emblem. Chorus means music, and music is a fundamental part of education. Our brother is a great educator. And this scene is very beautiful. Now let us come to the next.
After him, as Homer says, I lifted up my eyes and saw Hippias the Elean sitting in the opposite cloister on a chair of state, and around him were seated in benches Eryximachus, the son of Acumenus, and Phaedrus the Myrinusian, and Andron, the son of Androtion, and there were strangers, both from his native Elis and some others. They were putting to Hippias certain physical and astronomical questions, and he, ex cathedra, was passing judgment upon their several questions and discussing them.
Yeah. Now Hippias is presented as sitting, as you see, and his Arzaran also, and three men mentioned by name. He sits in the center of a circle, not at the head of an army like Protagoras. And here's the subject is mentioned, not physical things and astronomical things. No, astronomical things are of special interest because in Aristophanes' Clouds, his oldest presentation of Socrates, the old peasant who wants to become Socrates' pupil, Strepsiades, has some interest in all subjects which Socrates teaches, except astronomy. It's too far away, too high. Now, here in the case of Hippias, the comrades, the synontes, the band together with him, ask questions and do not merely listen, as you see. Two of them, Eryximachus and Phaedrus, occur in important positions in the banquet, making speeches there. At the beginning of this passage, he quotes Homer. This one I also saw. But of course not Homer says it, if you would look it up, but Odysseus. And we draw this provision conclusion that Socrates is here, appearing here in this dialogue in the role of Odysseus. Hippias, I mean the verse quoted refers there of course not to Hippias, but to Heracles, but only to the phantom of Heracles. So the true Heracles is not, of physics and astronomy we can conclude is not Hippias. Hippias was known rather as a foolish man. Let us turn now to the third group.
Also mine eyes beheld Tantalus, for Prodicus the Chian was at Athens too. He had been lodged in a room which in the days of Hipponicus
was this is the father of Callias, a very rich man, and Callias ruins the fortune. Yes?
In the days of Hipponicus was a storehouse, but as the house was full, Callias had cleared this out and made the room into a guest room. Now Prodicus was still in bed, wrapped up in sheepskins and bedclothes, of which there seemed to be a great heap. And there was sitting near by him on the couches Pausanias, the deme of Carameus, and with Pausanias was a youth quite young, who is certainly remarkable for his good looks, and, if I am not mistaken, is also of a fair and gentle nature. I thought that I heard him called Agathon, and my suspicion is that he is the beloved of Pausanias. There was this youth, and also there were the two Adeimantuses, one the son of Cephas and the other of Lucolophides, and some others. I was very anxious to hear what Prodicus was saying, for he seems to me to be an all-wise and inspired man, but I was not able to get into the inner circle, and his deep voice made an echo in the room which rendered his words inaudible.
Yes. Now Prodicus is compared to Tantalus.
Pandalus suffers from pain. Prodicus is lying in an empty storehouse. You know, just as Tantalus will not get any food, Prodicus will not get food. Prodicus is the least conspicuous of the three sophists, as is here also indicated by the fact that he says, oh yes, Prodicus also was there, as if he had not thought of him. He is the closest of the three to Socrates, but there is no dialogue Prodicus, as I mentioned before. Prodicus lies in bed. He's a very soft man. This also is confirmed by a remark about him in Aristotle's Cloud. Here there are four men mentioned by name. Two of them again, speakers in the banquet, Pausanias and Agatho. The subject of their conversation is inaudible because of the acoustics. Socrates says only in the case of Prodicus that he was eager to hear what he says, but he couldn't hear. Prodicus is apparently the least accessible of the three sophists. Yeah. You come in and you see immediately Prodicus, and then you see also very soon Hippias, but since he is lying in a special, Prodicus is lying in a special room, he's the least accessible. And now, it is very strange, here is again the same passage in the Odyssey. Also Socrates sees Tantalus, and that is Prodicus, and he sees the shadow of Heracles, that is Hippias, and one is eager to know who is a Homeric equivalent of Protagoras. Now, this I will anticipate later developments, 393e following. Protagoras is Achilles, in a way the greatest of all heroes, but in that health scene described in the 11th book of the Odyssey, where this passage comes from, Hades scene, Achilles is no longer that great hero, but is only has become converted from all belief in courage and prefers a life of a poor laborer, a poor laborer who is alive, to the misery of the dead, even however great heroes they may have been. Only among Prodicus' companions do we find a couple of lovers. When he mentions Pausanias and Agathon, these names become meaningful to the banquet. The other two men have the same names, Adimantos, are both called. Now it was Prodicus's specialty to make a distinction between different words which seem to mean the same thing, but mean in fact different things. We will find some examples of it later. Here they have the same name, Adimantos, but they are different. Prodicus has the same number of companions mentioned by name as Socrates in the Gorgias. Whether that is meaningful is another matter. Now we come to a brief scene of some importance. Yes?
No sooner had we entered than there followed us Alcibiades the Beautiful, as you say, and I believe you, and also Critias, the son of Callaeschrus.
Yes. Now Socrates and Tiburus come late, but not too late, as Socrates and Chaerephon came in the Gorgias. After them come only Alcibiades and Critias. The question is, do they belong to Socrates, as the other men named belong to one or the other of these wise men? Socrates was accused, according to Xenophon, of having corrupted Critias and Alcibiades and thus harmed the city. Under the democracy, Alcibiades, and under the oligarchy, Critias. Socrates has, if they belong to Socrates, Socrates has three companions just as Hippias. Socrates tells the Protagoras, as we will see, tells the Protagoras to the comrade while sitting. We have seen that in 310a. And as we will see, the conversation with Protagoras takes place also while they are sitting. Now sitting has something to do with idleness. I have the only observation I have is in a very late order, but well right in the classic many, Pico della Mirandola, his statement of the dignity of man, which is quite well known. The wise Pythagoras will warn us not to sit too much, that is, not to loosen the reins of the rational part, whereby the soul measures, judges, and examines everything, and not to lose it in slothful idleness. I tell you this for whatever it may be worth. Conversation between Socrates and Hippocrates takes place while they are walking around in the vestibule of Socrates, like Protagoras and his group. There is no parallel with Prodicus, unless you will say the very beginning of the Hippocrates section, where Socrates is also lying in bed, as Prodicus is lying in bed here. But much more important, the Protagoras we see here presents Socrates' Odysseus, Socrates' dash Odysseus, descent to Hades. I have given you some indication of that from the very beginning, the very first words. From where come you up to sight? I mean, this gesture, I am. From where do you come to sight? But it is easily completed this way. And the Cerberus, who watches the door. Now this is, Plato makes this pun more than once.
Hades, Hades.
Hades, Aides, the invisible. In the Phaedo and in the Gorgias also. The invisibility of the ideas, but also the invisibility of wisdom. In the dialogue Sophist, Hades is called a sophist. But there is also an amusing story. This takes place in the house of Callias, and here I must give you a piece of Athenian gossip. Callias was married, and he had a strange mother-in-law who started to have illicit relations with her son-in-law, Callias. And so Callias lived together with the daughter and the mother, like Pluto, Hades, the god of the netherworld, with his wife Demeter and daughter Persephone. And therefore he was called Hades in Athenian gossip. And this is, by the way, the background of Xenophon's writing called Economicus, because there we know this much, that the father-in-law of Callias was called Ischomachus. But in the Economicus, the hero is called Ischomachus, however without his father's name. In Ischomachus was a very common name, so one cannot know. But he could very well be, and there are some reasons for assuming, the father-in-law of Callias. Now, this Ischomachus tells Socrates a very long story of what a wonderful educator of his young wife he was. He was at the time perhaps 1 or 2 years married, and she was completely innocent when she married him, and he educated her, so she was a model of a wife. And it would be that we don't know how this wife looked 10 years later. Our imagination is fertilized by this reading of the speech by Andocides on the Mysteries, in which this story of Callias' household is told. But this jocular point, which is by no means unworthy of Plato, but which we must mention, we are in Hades, it confirmed that. And Hades is of course a place of terror, from which one would run away. Now in a way, this is exactly what happens at the end of the Protagoras, where sugar is, in a way runs away. And in this situation of having run away from Hades, because he meets the comrades, and in a relieved way to be out of the terrible place, he tells them of his adventures in Hades. That does make sense. Sugar belongs to the world of the living, to the city. But he has once been in Hades. He has once been with the sophists. Now there are altogether 19 individuals mentioned by name here in this section, and the whole in the whole dialogue Protagoras. That's in the center from two different points of view. However you count, you find either Phaedrus, the hero of the dialogue Phaedrus, and also in a way of the banquet, and according to another counting, Eryximachus, the physician, who in the banquet exchanges his place with Aristophanes. Now the account of the sophists here is obviously comic. I think that there is universal agreement with regard to that. And this of course could only have been done in a narrated dialogue. The dialogue on Socrates' meeting with the sophists had to be narrated, since Socrates could not speak of their ridiculous character to the sophists themselves. Is this not clear? He could not have brought out their ridiculous character in this way in conversation with them, but only in conversation about them. But why is it a narrated dialogue preceded by a performed dialogue? In other words, to what kind of people does Socrates narrate the conversation? And the simple answer, to quite ordinary people. There is nothing extraordinary, nothing secret, at least, about what went on at that meeting. Nevertheless, that meeting with Protagoras still needs a decent justification, and that decent justification is given by the central section. The conversation with Hippocrates. So let us go there for the sake of Hippocrates. There is another point to consider. However, if sophistry is ridiculous, it cannot be truly harmful. See Aristotle's Poetics, chapter 5, and Plato's Philebus, 49. Why is it presented as ridiculous, i.e. as not harmful? The simplest explanation, and here I come back to something what you meant, it could be understood as a plea for the toleration of sophists by the city. Such toleration might be necessary if philosophy is to be tolerated. For the city is perhaps not able to distinguish properly between sophistry and philosophy. This degree of liberalism I regard as perfectly compatible with Socrates and Plato. I don't know whether it meets your bill, but it is of some importance, I believe. So, now let us read the next speech and then we...
On entering, we stopped a little in order to look about us, and then walked up to Protagoras, and I said, Protagoras...
Now, wait a moment. Who are the we? That's the question. You see, if you look three lines below this, when we entered, three lines before, the beginning of the preceding speech.
Beginning of the preceding speech?
No, well, I got, where are you now? Yeah, no sooner had we entered. Yep. No, it's before, no sooner had we entered. Who are the we there?
Hippocrates and Socrates.
And who are the we in the next speech?
Presumably those two, plus Alcibiades and
yeah.
Critias.
Possibly, at least. Possibly, at least. Yeah, good. Now go.
And walked up to Protagoras, and I said, Protagoras, my friend Hippocrates here and I...
Of course, there is no friend. I mean, that is sentimental. There's no friend.
Hippocrates here and I have come to see you. Do you wish, he said, to speak with me alone or in the presence of the company?
Yeah, let us stop here. Now, as I said before, the we now who enter might be Socrates, Alcibiades, Critias, and Hippocrates, and that would mean that Alcibiades and Critias belong to Socrates' group, just as Hippias has his group, Protagoras, and Protagoras. Now, Socrates knows Protagoras, that is perfectly clear, and Protagoras knows him. Hippocrates does not know Protagoras. That's different in the Gorgias, where Socrates' companion, Xylophon, knows Gorgias better than Socrates does. You see, Socrates knows Protagoras from earlier meetings. There is a relative frequency of Socrates meetings with Protagoras, maybe two, maybe three times, maybe more, contrasted with the infrequency of his coming to Callias' house. The eunuch didn't know him, the doorman. The meeting which Socrates had with Protagoras, or meetings which Socrates had with Protagoras, not for the sake of Hippocrates, are not reported by either Plato or Socrates. That we must figure out for ourselves. We know only of this particular meeting. So Protagoras in his reply suggests that Socrates and Hippocrates might have something private to talk with, something personal, something to hide before the public. Now what does Socrates say to that?
Whichever you please, I said, you shall determine when you have heard the purpose of our visit.
Yeah, Socrates says no, but perhaps you, you Protagoras, might like to have a private meeting. In other words, Protagoras presents Socrates and Hippocrates with the choice, and Socrates turns the table. No, you choose. You will see that this is of some importance. And now Socrates states the subject of the visit.
What is your purpose, he said. I must explain, I said, that Hippocrates is a native of Athenian. He is the son of Apollodorus and of a great and prosperous house, and he is himself in natural ability regarded as quite a match for anybody of his own age. I believe that he aspires to political eminence, and he thinks that association with you is most likely to procure this for him. And now you can determine whether you would wish to speak to him of your teaching alone or in the presence of the company.
Yeah. You see here, Socrates says nothing about Hippocrates' nature. He says he is supposed to be gifted. He doesn't say he is. You're regarded as he translates. He says something about his family background, his social position, the son of a wealthy house, etc. And then he also says something about his motive, but qualified. He seems, well, in Greek it is so, he seems, according to his nature, to be competitive with his contemporaries. He seems to me, that's Socrates' view, not the general view, to desire to become famous in the city. That is to be taken more seriously, as you see. Now, from this, if we disregard the last sentence, it would follow, there is no need for a private talk. This is an average boy, there is nothing very interesting, as you can see. But nevertheless, Socrates repeats here again, you, Protagoras, must make your choice between private and public discussion. And then in that long speech of Protagoras which follows, which we cannot read today, Protagoras makes his choice. That one can almost repeat this common saying, you pay your money, and I make the choice. This can. So Protagoras makes his choice in favor of public discussion. And the reason given in a very long and beautiful, not to say pompous speech, is I have nothing to hide. I have nothing to hide, but the others have something, other sophists. They hide their teaching. I do not do, and it is very foolish to hide anything, because that only makes people more suspicious. And so it will be public. But Socrates has a feeling, Socrates is very clever, as you see, very odyssean, has a feeling that the reason why Protagoras wants to have this public discussion was not that he had nothing to hide, but that he wanted to show off before his competitors, the other sophists. Now, this statement is quite remarkable. Protagoras is the first sophist who reveals the fact that he is a sophist. He is the first sophist who speaks up. The first who speaks up is almost a literal translation of his name. Protos, first, agora, and speaking. The first man who speaks up. And and then why did the former sophists conceal their being sophists? That we must discuss next time. So we continue at this place. And then there are some other long speeches of Protagoras in which he explains the meaning of his art, and after that the discussion begins. But the discussion is wholly unintelligible if we do not hear first from the Protagoras' own mouth from what his claim is. And we turn to that next time. Fun?
Mind necessarily. As the most natural of all dependence itself is his amour propre. So, pride, if we use this term as his translation, it does not yet exist because he is radically asocial. He is not yet concerned with the opinion of others. That only confirms what we have seen hitherto, and in the fourth book, with the awakening of sexual desire, then there comes the socialization, to use a term which is now frequently used. I would like to mention only one point which I believe I have not emphasized enough, and that is that while amour propre is frequently used by Rousseau as it to designate the root of all evil, that is not universally so in Rousseau. He says somewhere in the second discourse, amour propre is the origin of all our virtues and all our vices. In other words, everything specifically human, because self-preservation is common to men and the beasts, is akin somehow to amour propre. And therefore the citizen, for example, in the full sense, is unthinkable without amour propre, and the clearest sign of it is patriotism, which is traced by Rousseau to amour propre. In other words, as long as mere self-preservation determines a man's willingness to enter civil society, it is without sentiment, it's a mere calculation. I'm better off as a member of society than without it. And part of the sentiment of patriotism is linked up with self-love, with pride of this particular society in contradistinction to others.
Even the legislator, when you read in the Social Conduct Book 2, Chapter 7, the beginning, the motive of the legislator is love of immortal glory, which belongs under the heading Amor Propre. Mr. Morrison?
Amor Propre is often translated, I think, as self-respect.
Yeah, it could take on this.
I was wondering if there is a relation between self-preservation and self-respect. Self-respect is no. When self-preservation...
No, there is no connection. Self-preservation is what man shares with the brutes. Only man can use his reason for preserving himself because he doesn't have sufficiently good instincts. But this is strictly a reason used in the service of self-preservation has nothing to do with what the others think about you. In the moment one is concerned with the others, what the others think about oneself, then amor propre exists. Now there are of course various forms. There can be a very silly vanity, and in the highest sense it is desire for immortal glory. But all these phenomena have this in common, that man is concerned with what other human beings think about him. That I believe one can say is probably the most general definition of amor propre which one can give. We must keep this in mind.
As anything, it's the sense that for a person to have an idea that he himself is worth something,
yes,
is perhaps a halfway
stage. No, that is amor propre. Because in self-preservation, no such, because one cannot say being worth of something without some incipient comparison. And in the moment the comparison enters, amor propre begins. But as long as you are concerned merely with self-preservation, you are wholly indifferent to the opinion of others.
But it's in this sense that amor propre, self-respect, could be seen as being in a particularly close connection with self-preservation, perhaps as some kind of next step up.
How? That I failed to see.
Because the roots.
You mean this? Only accidentally, because sometimes your self-preservation may depend on what other things about you. Only in this way, but that is accidental. For example, take any of these everyday occurrences in the old American West, whether you are suspected of being a horse thief and therefore hanged or not, depends very much on what the people think about you. But you must, that is accidental. That does not belong to the essence of that belief.
Well, it's conceivable to think of a situation where self-respect would lead you to deny self-preservation.
Exactly. Yeah, sure. No, all these things which elevate man beyond mere self-preservation, like prejudice, and those which degrade him by being concerned with what do these people whisper about me? Yeah? All these things belong together, and therefore the soul says amor propre is the root of all our virtues and all our vices. The motive which men have to develop the virtues and vices proper is always, in his sense, amor propre. So we may say amour propre, in contradistinction to self-love, is specifically human, whereas self-preservation in itself is not specifically human, while the means for self-preservation, reason in the service of self-preservation, is of course specifically human. Mr. Schmidt.
Would Aristotle say that the concern for honor, for instance, in a good man is akin to this notion of amour propre?
Yeah, but amour propre has this a kind of derogatory implication nevertheless, which is absent. And also says about the magnanimous man, he's a man
deserving great honors and claiming them, you know, then there is nothing, no indication. Perhaps Aristotle was too Jane Austenian here. That is a long question, but still Aristotle has no indication of anything, how should I say, low, you know. I mean, in other words, he would not do the right thing. He would act wrongly in not claiming these honors. It has a kind of objectivity which has nothing to do with his subjective feelings, if one may use this thing.
I don't know the German terms, but Nietzsche makes a distinction between pride and vanity.
Yeah, very common.
Sufficient? Is it something like the Aristotelian magnanimous man's
Aristotle does not, let me put it this way, Aristotle refuses to praise any virtue to passion. Virtue is for Aristotle an attitude toward passion and never a passion. Well, think of the Platonic simple image, the charioteer and the two horses, yeah? The noble and the base horse. These are the passions, the horse. The charioteer is reason. And that is, virtue is a charioteer. It needs some horses, yeah? But not as the motive, but in order to control them. For example, the desire for honor is very common. I don't say universal. I have seen people who are absolutely indifferent to them, but very common. And now, what is virtue is not the desire for honor, but the attitude toward it, that you claim honors when it is right to claim them, and for the reason why it is right to claim them. Namely, for example, one reason could be that it is simply showing disrespect, as you degrade in a very high office if you do not demand the honors habitually going with it, this kind of thing. Yeah? I mean, it is thinkable, after all, that a man without being in any way passionately interested in honors would demand them for objective reason. It's not imaginable. And a very simple case, I'm sure there must be many officers, subaltern officers and even non-commissioned officers who insisted on being properly treated by recruits without being in any way inflated or by that, simply they have to do it. It's part of the military order, and that can even be applied to the political order, you know. Well, I mean, for example, it is thinkable that someone sets the record of his activities straight, as say church wrestler, without being concerned with fame as such, but with being as a kind of, so that people may be able to judge properly of what was done while he was in charge of rich forces, is possible. And I think that Aristotle has in mind whether his notion that Aristotle never believed that true virtue is very frequent, but he would say it is possible, definitely possible, and he presented it as how it is when it is the genuine stuff. And therefore, there is no passionate motive, strictly speaking, for virtue. I mean, in our present day sense of the word passion, the word passion has changed its sense, so much so we speak today of passion as a term of praise very frequently. Yeah? For Aristotle, passion is not a term of praise, nor in itself of dispraise. It depends on depends very much what passion and what degree of it. But the seat of virtue is never in the passions. And in modern times, this what was the 17th and 18th century thinkers tried to do was to find a passionate substitute for virtue that could be done. I mean, Hobbes was a tough fellow, and he felt the fear of violent death. That makes a man good. As the more popular versions, of course, sentiments. Yeah, I mean, nice sentiments from which sentimentality was derived. That's also not a reason in the driver's seat. On the contrary, sentiment. Mr. Muller?
Well, Rousseau makes generosity earlier depend on, I don't know whether it's on Lothrop or, well, in a way, but it's a real sense of Emile's, his sense of, it's founded in his true superiority in that business of racing for the cakes.
Yeah, but that is awkward for him, you know, for Rousseau. Because after all, whether you can, I mean, one thing are the virtues of a man fully developed and an outstanding, a man of outstanding virtue, as Aristotle has in mind when he writes. Or the other thing is what you can do with immature human beings, and especially children. Now, Aristotle has made this very clear. There is he hasn't spoken of competition and this kind of thing, but of sense of shame. This is example. Now, and you see, sense of shame means a sense that one has done the wrong thing. And Aristotle, in his wisdom, says that the virtuous man doesn't have sense of shame. He doesn't do anything wrong. Do you? But young people who cannot possibly have the maturity are bound to make mistakes, and it suits them well. And the same could be applied to desire for superiority as a motive. But one must also say, I mean, however fantastic the statements of Aristotle may sound, when you look at them in specific cases, and Aristotle bids you, as it were, all the time, look at it in terms of specific cases, they are not so, they are sensible. For example, when you see a man being ambitious, now let us assume in a higher sense, you know, not for money and positions, but so. As soon, and so that it is in a higher sense, and yet whenever you become aware of it, one cannot help feeling it is petty. We cannot admire a man if he is not to the extent to which he is not dedicated. We can say very well, and that is absolutely necessary, I think, from the point of view of any humanity, that it is almost impossible for a man to be without that. And yet, this is not what we mean in esteeming a man. That also has in mind this dedication, so that you do not need a passion. Although we call today such dedication passion. That is a long story.
If it wasn't a contradiction in terms for the magnanimous man to fall away, to do something that wasn't right, and if no one was around, would he still blush?
He wouldn't do it.
Okay, well then,
he would not. He simply wouldn't make a mistake. I mean, in other words, what do you mean? He could conceivably do something, assuming something perfectly all right if one is alone, yeah. And by some accident, someone is there without his knowing. Well, then you cannot really say he did something wrong. Yeah, I mean. I don't know, for example, not being fully dressed, and yet someone happens to be in the room because he has entered through the window. He could not possibly have known it. That is nothing to be ashamed of. It may be slightly embarrassing. Aristotle means that Plato's view is somewhat different, because what Plato's teaching about eros as present in every high thing, it could be crudely rendered passion as present, yeah? The philosophic passion.
But it is interesting that Plato doesn't call it the philosophic pathos, but the philosophic eros, which is not quite the same thing. Rabbi Weiss?
I'm kind of a little confused about the meaning of power of comfort. Emil does have a regard for himself, doesn't he?
But this doesn't come up. Is a puppy vain or dog? He is in this sense naive. He doesn't know this. Is it not thinkable that men also maybe? Children when play sometimes, yeah, are also wholly indifferent to what the other children think about it. They're completely delicate. Emil is such a child who has no, that is the point, who don't even know what that is.
Well, I don't quite see.
Now, if you do, can make an experiment. Sometimes you see extreme cases of people who have a kind of persecution maneuver and think that all other people have no other concern but with them. You know, whenever someone makes a remark, they assume they are meant by it. Do you know this kind of thing? Have you seen those people? I have seen some. Now, if you take this extreme case, you can, by a simple process of the imagination, figure out a case of someone who is wholly immune to this kind of thought. And one can say, in a sense, can say this is an absolutely naive man. I mean, a man who is not in any sense self-conscious. That is what he means.
Can't such a man have virtue?
Yeah, but surely he can, but he doesn't have it yet.
I understand that Emil doesn't have virtue. You quoted from the second discourse that indeed.
That Rousseau seems to me that without the impulse of a passion, I mean, of such a passion, of amour propre, there is a statement, I think Cicero makes it somewhere, how come that the philosophers who write about the contempt of glory books put their name on the title page? Yeah. And in other words, it is surely not so free. I mean, complete absence of it will be very rare. To that extent, Rousseau is right. But the point which there makes be maybe only a difference of degree, but I believe it is an essential difference. Whether virtue is altogether understood in terms of passions, Spinoza is teaching a passion can be overcome only by another passion. And say that the passion for glory could overcome all kinds of other passions. And if it is a lofty enough notion of glory, it could lead to very high things. But I can only say this is not the Aristotelian, and fundamentally not the Platonic understanding. Yeah.
Going back to something where you first replied to Simon's question about magistrates. Sovereignty and magistrates of Rousseau's scheme. The thing that I'm not clear about is, as I understand his ordering of government, as far as its executive arm of the sovereignty, it seems that the magistrates themselves only execute orders which are given to them by the sovereignty.
What about war and peace?
What about
war and peace? The sovereign is only the leader.